Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Extinction by Kyle West, narrated by Graham Halstead. Prologue. Makara, Samuel, Michael, and Julian had escaped the Gilgamesh crash site. At the same time, there were certain facts that couldn't be ignored. While they had escaped, they were still very much in danger. They were in the Great Blight, far from water and health, and likely surrounded by blighters. It would take days, if not weeks, for them to make it back to the wasteland, assuming they didn't die on the way. There was no way of knowing their destination, either. One thing was certain, however. Without a spaceship, the Exodus was stranded in Bunker 84 with only 2 weeks of food left. And unless Augustus rescued them, they would eventually starve. I couldn't see any solution other than what Augustus had proposed, to join forces with him. The Wanderer had said we needed to unite, but all the same, it was hard to imagine a world where the Empire, the Reapers, and the Angels worked together. But that was what had to happen if we were ever to beat the Ratiskim. Makara, at least, wouldn't stand for such an alliance, mostly because of the Reapers. Both she and Anna wanted Karen Black dead for his crimes. But what choice do we have? Ascala was ready to wipe out humanity, and she wasn't going to stop with the wasteland. Despite discovering my four friends were alive, we were still in the custody of Emperor Augustus. Anna, Ashton, and I had each been locked in separate cabins. If there was a future alliance in the works, as Augustus had said, it wasn't off to a great start. The Emperor's first item of business was probably going to Los Angeles to meet with Karen Black and the Reapers. Augustus and Black held all the cards. I didn't know what Karen Black was like. All I knew was that he had destroyed both Makara's and Anna's lives, not to mention Samuel's and countless others as well. Back in 2055, the powerful Reapers overthrew the weakening Lost Angels, killing their leader Rain, and forcing surviving members to flee into the wasteland or face enslavement. Both Makara and Samuel had been forced to find new lives, Makara as a raider, and Samuel as a scientist in Bunker 114. Anna's settlement of Last Town had been assaulted by the Reapers earlier. When her father was killed in the fighting, she and her mother fled into the wasteland, where they'd survived for years. Whoever Karen Black was, he wasn't someone I wanted to work with. I wasn't even sure if he was even someone I wanted alive, and I definitely knew both Makara and Anna wanted him dead. Samuel had said little on the subject, but his feelings were probably much the same. At some point, Anna, Ashton, and I would have to meet the Warlord of the Reapers. A change was coming. I didn't know what it was, but I felt it. It wasn't just with the Great Blight and Ascala. It was with humanity. Augustus had rescued us, but whose side was he really on? He talked of alliance and friendship, but it was difficult to believe him. Maybe he did want everyone working together. As Emperor of Nova Roma, he was probably used to getting people who didn't like each other on the same page. I had a hard time figuring out the guy. In the end, though, Augustus was probably on his own side. His hope was probably to get both the Reapers and the Angels working for him. Assuming we defeated Ascala, Augustus could take control of the wasteland. I had nothing but questions, questions that couldn't be answered until I was let out of my cabin. For now, Augustus thought victory was as simple as attacking the voice and defeating it in open battle. We hadn't been able to tell him everything else we'd learned, including my own role. The only way to defeat Ascala was infecting her with the Elikai version of the Xenovirus, which was something only I could do. According to the Wanderer, it would cost me my life. He had also said that we must unite. Maybe it was best to follow his advice, regardless of what anyone thought about it. Allying the Reapers, the Empire, and the Angels would be the most difficult thing we'd done. And none of us had any idea how to do it. Chapter 1. "Did you hear that?" Julian asked. Makara opened her eyes. "Hear what?" The recon sat alone in a mountain valley coated with xenofungus, sheltered within a stand of xenotrees. The tree's spindly limbs fell in a silvery cascade, obscuring the recon from view. The fungus itself glowed in the night, milky and pink. Frail alien trees spiraled from the xenofungal bed, their hanging limbs and tufts and fronds spilling like silk onto the ground. Tall pink tubes rose from the fungus, their bell openings dripping slime that collected in sticky, shining pools. Alien chirps, clicks, and shrieks sounded from distant hills.
"Is there something out there?" Samuel asked.
"What do you think it was, Julian?" Makara asked. "Hard to believe," Julian said. "But it sounded like a spaceship." Outside, the xenolife chirped on.
"No, it couldn't have been that," Michael said, now awake. "You saw Aeneas fall."
Julian paused.
"Maybe it was nothing. I was just sleeping and thought I heard it. I must have dreamt it."
Satisfied at this answer, everyone closed their eyes once again. Bunker 84 was far, but Samuel had estimated that the group could get there in a few more days. For some reason, Julian doubted that assessment. They'd be lucky to get there at all. 3 days after Samuel's estimate, and they had crossed over into Nevada. They had expected to find desert, but instead found more blight. It had expanded farther than any of them would have thought. Julian closed his eyes. Even though he was exhausted, he couldn't fall asleep. It was Samuel's turn to be on watch, as Julian had done it last night, which meant sleep should have been coming easy. But he couldn't stop thinking about the others. Alex, Anna, Ashton, all dead, crashed into the mountainside. They had driven by the wreckage of Aeneas first thing, before Gilgamesh itself had become a burning ruin. Aeneas's hull was so disintegrated that it was impossible to explore the ship on foot, much less check for empty escape pods. They had searched a full day throughout the valley, but it became clear that they couldn't search forever. It was far too cold and dangerous to go into the mountains out of the blighted valley. Besides, a pod could have landed anywhere, and the recon had very little in the way of emergency supplies, supplies they couldn't stretch on a fruitless search. Already they were rationing, eating half as much as they should. In the end, Samuel had made the final decision. They were to return to Bunker 84 and try to save everyone there without spaceships. Assuming they actually made it to the bunker, this would involve a journey south over mountains in the dead of winter. Assuming anyone made it, Samuel planned to offer the New Angels' services to Augustus and Karen Black. Not a satisfying ending, but the only ending, nonetheless. During their journey southwest, the Great Blight had been surprisingly empty of threats. Makara guessed that Ascala was gathering her swarm in one place for one final attack, which had emptied much of the Great Blight. Perhaps they hadn't run into any crawlers, but that didn't mean they wouldn't at some point. If, against all odds, they reached Bunker 84, then what? The New Angels would only freeze and starve in the mountains on the perilous journey south. Many would rather stay in the bunker, even if there wasn't enough food to go around. By the time they reached Los Angeles on foot, the New Angels' dead would probably outnumber the living. Their numbers would be too few to have leverage with Augustus or Black. Maybe the number of angels would be as few as zero. Maybe that was why Julian had heard the spaceship. If not wishful thinking, then maybe it was wishful hearing. But Julian couldn't shake the thought. What if it was a spaceship? There were two left, Perseus and Orion, both locked away in Bunker 6. There was no way anyone besides the New Angels could access it. Bunker 6 was not too far north of Bunker 1, and was even deeper in the Great Blight, making it more inaccessible than the former headquarters of the United States government. There was no way either of those ships could be flying around. There was no one on Earth that could pilot them besides Makara
Ashton and Anna. Again, Julian's thoughts turned back to Alex. If he was really dead, they had to find another solution. That meant talking to the Wanderer. But how, without having the speed of a spaceship? No one had explicitly said that all hope was gone in the 2 days since the crash. Samuel had merely ordered everyone to head back to Bunker 84. Julian was sure, however, that he wasn't the only one being haunted by these thoughts. The only solution that Julian could see was for the Wanderer to select a new person to fill Alex's role. But maybe that wasn't possible. After all, hadn't the Wanderer prophesied that Alex was the only one who could defeat the Radiskim? In the passenger seat, Samuel adjusted his legs.
Still awake, Julian?
Julian nodded.
Yeah. I'm stepping outside.
Makara stirred as the door opened but didn't wake. Michael opened a single eye, then fell right back asleep. Julian opened his own door, stepping onto the padded xenofungal surface of the Great Blight. The air was warm and moist. Both water and heat rose from the organic growth below. A gentle wind blew, warm. It seemed strange that the Great Blight, the most dangerous place in the world, had the mildest weather. A few steps ahead, Samuel swept hanging tree limbs out of the way, revealing an incline of a few feet, ending at a high precipice. Blighted plains stretched below. At the end of the plains, about 3 miles distant, rose glowing, jagged mountains. They reminded Julian of teeth, the broken, rotting teeth of a broken, rotting world. Samuel went to stand at the edge of the cliff, and Julian stood a short distance to the side. Above, the skies had somewhat cleared, a rare occurrence in the Great Blight. A small window to the heavens had opened, a black void filled with a swath of bright, shining stars. A purplish band of light streaked across the small opening in the clouds.
The Milky Way, Julian said, stepping up beside Samuel. We'd see it at night, in New America. Here, not so much. Too cloudy.
Samuel gazed upward, saying nothing. Julian scanned the valley below. According to the recon's navigation, there should have been a highway down there, running east and west. There was no sign of it now. First buried by years of dust, next buried by the xenoviral incursion. Likely it was buried forever, just as all the old world would one day be. Even if we make it in time, Julian said, will it make any difference? Staring out at the alien landscape, Samuel took time before he answered, as if weighing the unexpressed feelings behind the question itself.
You never know. You should never give up hope as long as you're breathing. You never know if salvation is beyond the next rise.
Julian was about to respond, but found he had no words. They stood another moment before Julian spoke again.
What about Alex, though? Julian asked. The Wanderer said,
Alex cannot be dead, Samuel said.
Julian's eyes widened.
How do you know that?
It all depends on the interpretation of the Wanderer's prophecy, Samuel said. The Wanderer said that Alex had to be there for the final battle. Therefore, he has to be there. I refuse to believe that he is dead.
Julian didn't know how to respond. Samuel's belief was not based on logic, a rarity for someone so rational. Then again, his reason did have a certain logic to it. As Samuel said, it all depended on the interpretation.
They have their course, Samuel said. We have ours.
Something about Samuel's words struck Julian.
Wait, their course?
If they made it, as I believe they have, then they are doing what they have to do. They must have made peace with the fact that they'll never see civilization again.
Samuel turned to Julian.
Ragnarok Crater isn't too far from the crash site. Maybe 200 miles? It can be done.
That gave Julian pause. Could they really be trying to walk to Ragnarok Crater? To travel through the mountains and the great blight without food and water seemed impossible. Then again, maybe not. If Alex was alive, he could summon his dragon friend and be rescued. If that was the case, Alex would have found them by now. It had been 3 days, after all, and no sign of any dragon, Elikai or Radiskim.
I choose to believe because I cannot accept the alternative, Samuel said. If Alex is dead, then there's nothing more we can do. But until we see it with our own eyes, we fight.
The two friends gazed into the silent valley. Julian could only wonder where Samuel found his hope. Perhaps he was still young enough to have it. Not that Julian was much older than Samuel's 23. 25 years I have lived, Julian thought. Would 2 more years make such a difference in my outlook on life? Maybe hope was a choice. Julian wondered what it would be like to believe Alex was alive, that Anna and Ashton were both alive. And suddenly he realized that what he heard earlier made sense. It wasn't just a dream. I did hear a spaceship. Samuel turned, raising an eyebrow.
You're sure?
At least, I think I did, Julian said.
Who would fly it? Samuel asked.
If there was one, it came from Bunker 6. And yet, you guys made it as far as Bunker 1, Julian looked at Samuel. It's not impossible, is it?
Yes, but what would that mean? Samuel asked. Who would be flying it?
I don't know, Julian said. But if someone had a spaceship, where would they go?
Skyhome, perhaps?
As if he had received some sort of answer, Samuel turned back for the recon.
Where are you going? Julian asked.
Makara can try contacting Skyhome, Samuel said. It'll mean waiting until it's overhead, but Skyhome can track the spaceship for us. If it exists, that is.
Julian nodded. It seemed like a long shot. It would mean watching the night sky nonstop until they saw Skyhome streaking across like a massively bright star. They could send out a message every few minutes. Hopefully someone from Skyhome would answer. If there was another spaceship, it would change everything. They could track it down and find out who was flying it. Maybe that ship had rescued Alex and the others. The escape pod would have given off a signal that could be tracked by any ship in the U.S. space fleet. But if that was the case, would that ship have found the others? And if so, where were they going?
Chapter 2
The dream faded and I awoke aboard the Orion. I had seen them alive, figuring things out. I had no idea how I'd seen them, but it seemed real enough. Julian had heard the ship, and Samuel had thought it worth investigating. However, if what Augustus said was true, it would be impossible to track the ship. Jonas Sparks had disabled the tracker installed on Orion, meaning it couldn't be found. If Orion couldn't be found, Julian would be proven wrong and that would be the end of it. They would still head to Bunker 84. Whatever the case, there wasn't much we could do about our current situation. We had been locked in our cabins for 3 days. Of course, we had been disarmed. The Praetorians brought food and water 3 times a day and gave us the option to use the lavatory 30 minutes after each mealtime and before bed. The point was we wouldn't be getting out until Augustus said so. Our cabins were right next to each other, but I still hadn't seen Ashton or Anna in 3 days. Any attempt to talk through the bulwarks was futile. Not only could we not hear each other, the Praetorians could hear us from their posts in the corridor. I was starting to go crazy. We had to wait until the ship landed to get out, wherever that might be. So far, Augustus had revealed nothing. I hadn't even seen him since he'd locked me in here. We made one landing in the middle of day 2, but we just took right off again, heading somewhere different. I checked my watch. It was 16:42. There were no ports in the cabins, and the lights had been shut off 42 minutes ago. It would be turned on again in 12 hours. I thought about the dream I'd had. I needed to share it with Ashton and Anna, but unfortunately I had no way of doing that.
Even when we were escorted to the lavatory, we were let out at different times so there could be no sharing of information. It all depended on whether or not they knew about Orion. Julian had a hunch, but what would happen if they contacted Skyhome only to learn that there were no signals from a spaceship? Skyhome, I realized, was completely stranded without spaceships. Only Augustus had access to it, and surely he knew about it. The space city was so large that he couldn't fail to notice that impossibly bright star roving across the night sky. The question was, when would he visit it, and what would he do about it? If Makara and the others contacted Skyhome, would Augustus eventually figure out they were still alive? I was roused from my thoughts when I heard a light tapping emanating from the bulwark just to the left of my bunk. The tapping was extremely light, yet intentional, loud enough for me to hear, soft enough that it wouldn't catch the Praetorian's attention. I didn't know who was in the cabin next to mine. I reached for the metal bulwark. It felt cold against my fingers. I gave a few light taps, so tiny that I could barely hear them. The tapping from the other side stopped, and began a couple feet to the left of where I'd heard it last. Someone, either Ashton or Anna, was definitely trying to get my attention. I rose from my bunk, following the direction of the sound. I knelt by the head of my bunk, placing my ear against the wall. Tap, tap, tap. I responded with my own three taps. Again, the tapping ceased, beginning again from the corner of the compartment, as far as possible from the door. There was little risk of getting caught. Dinner wouldn't be served until 1800, so we had a little over an hour. Two more taps came from the corner. I waited for more. After a long pause, a few more taps came, three, all from different places in the wall. Someone was directly on the other side. "Hello?" I said softly. Of course, there was no response. There was no way the other person could hear me, and I didn't want to speak any louder. The three taps came again, from the same locations, one directly in front of my face, followed by two more at the level of my waist. "Ashton? Anna?" There was no way either of them could hear me, not unless I spoke louder. Whoever this was, they were trying to communicate something without speaking. I focused on the taps, realizing the key was there. The same three taps resounded at the same locations. There was a pattern here, if I could just figure it out. They were making a triangle for some reason. What did that mean? I realized then they weren't making a triangle, they were making the letter A. Ashton or Anna, that didn't really help me. I made my own A at the same three spots I had heard them come from. I quickly followed this with an L, which consisted of a tap in front of my face, one near my chest, and one to the right of that. There was a short pause before I heard a single tap, a series of taps in an S shape, followed by another tap, lower and on the opposite side of the first one. This person had made an S. "Ashton," I said. Of course the brilliant scientist would be the one to devise this method of communication. In case the point wasn't clear, he began spelling out the rest of his name with a capital H-T-O-N. I spelled mine start to finish as well, so that he would know for sure who I was. Over the next minute or two, he spelled out a message to me. "Anna, on other side." I wasn't sure if he was talking about the other side of the ship or on the compartment opposite of Ashton. I assumed the latter. I didn't want to waste time asking for confirmation, so I just wrote, "Okay." This was a surprisingly efficient way of communicating, so much so that it was a wonder we hadn't thought of it earlier. Morse code would have been easier, but none of us knew that. Maybe Ashton had been trying to do this for a while, but the taps had just been too soft for me to notice. I paused, thinking of what I might ask next. "Where are we going?" The response was quick. "L.A. I wanted to ask how Ashton knew, but then again I didn't want to waste any time. I decided to take his word for it. I wanted to ask Ashton why we'd been in the air for 3 days, but instead I tried to think of a message that wasn't too long. Another message came through the wall. Anna, okay. I had assumed that already. It probably would have been the first thing Ashton would have told me if she wasn't. Does she know? I hoped Ashton knew what I meant, whether Anna knew about our destination. Yes. Remembering my dream, I knew I needed to communicate it to Ashton. Had dream. Others are okay. I paused, giving Ashton the chance to respond. What else? Julian knows about ship. Ashton responded quickly. Good. That wasn't the complete truth. Julian had a hunch about the ship, but it was too late to take the message back without confusion. They would contact Skyhome, but Skyhome probably wouldn't be able to track Orion and confirm Julian's suspicion, unless Augustus revealed himself from there. I couldn't explain all that to Ashton through the wall, though. I was trying to think of something else to ask when the door slammed open. I turned toward the light, never looking more suspicious in my life. Maxillo himself stood in the doorway, Chief Praetorian of Nova Roma. He glowered as his eyes narrowed.
What are you doing? You are talking?
No, I said, walking to the center of the cabin and facing him.
It doesn't matter, Maxillo said. We will land soon. You can explain yourself to the Emperor then.
Outside in the corridor, more doors opened. We were all being taken out to prepare for our landing. For the first time in 3 days, I would see my friends. Maxillo nodded his head toward the corridor, indicating that I should exit the cabin. Beyond Maxillo, Ashton walked by, a Praetorian right behind him. The scientist looked in at me, his white hair and beard a wild mess. He gave me a sly wink. As he walked past the door, I went toward the doorway. By the time I reached it, Anna walked by, escorted by her own Praetorian. She cast me a quick glance before she was hidden by the bulwark. I stepped into the hallway. Maxillo gave me a light push, forcing me toward the wardroom. We were all made to sit at the table. Maxillo left us with 3 stone-faced Praetorians and headed for the bridge.
Stay quiet, he said. We will be in the city soon.
As instructed, none of us spoke. A moment later, the ship changed trajectory, angling downward. I held on to the edge of the table to steady myself. A few minutes later, we sunk vertically toward the ground. The ship gave a sudden lift before it settled onto the surface outside. At long last, we had arrived in Los Angeles. The blast door opened, revealing the sky burning fiery red from the setting sun. Buildings had crumbled onto one another, though most still stood. The decayed skyline, distant, was lost in reddish haze, not from the pollution of the old world, but from the dust of the new. We stood on the roof of a large, long building. Orion had perched on a helipad, its 3 struts barely fitting on the landing site. A cold, dry wind blew. Though cold, the breeze was warmer than I was used to. I had read something about oceans keeping coastal regions warmer than inland areas. Maybe that was why it was warmer. I didn't know why I was thinking such things when the situation was so dire. I stared at the decayed cityscape, the twisting towers, the crisscrossing streets clogged with the rusted shells of cars and trucks, low-lying buildings stained with 30 years of dust and debris. A hand pushed me down the boarding ramp toward the tarmac. Ashton and Anna were right behind. No one spoke. The Praetorians made a stand at the bottom of the ramp, facing out. As more feet clomped down, I looked at the fallen city. The crimson sky cast blood-like light on the buildings. To the east, mountains marched north to south, making a natural wall. Far to the north, even more mountains crisscrossed east to west. I even saw buildings in the eastern lifeless hills, despite how far they were. Trees stood, but most were long dead. Maybe all. In the 30 years since Ragnarok, Los Angeles had been reclaimed by the desert. A line of rubble rose within the inner city, cutting that section off from its outskirts.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?